Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On today's program, we are listening to two conversations taped in the last week with a famous court watcher and a famous virus hunter. As these are recorded conversations, we will not be taking calls today, but believe me, these are two fascinating guests worth listening to. In the second half of today's show, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. Nathan Wolfe. He's known as the Indiana Jones of virus hunting. He's visiting the University of Illinois campus on Monday to discuss how to forecast and ultimately prevent new viruses from becoming pandemics. We'll hear how he believes that can be accomplished a little later in the hour. But first, when oral arguments take place within the halls of the U.S. Supreme Court or the nation's high court issues an important ruling, there is really only one voice you need to turn to. Nina Totenberg, NPR's award-winning legal affairs correspondent. Totenberg is coming to the University of Illinois on Monday to give a talk in connection with receiving the Illinois Prize for Lifetime Achievement in Journalism. The talk is free and open to the public and will begin at 2 p.m. Monday in the auditorium at the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at 405 North Matthews Avenue in Urbana. Nina Totenberg, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Congratulations on receiving this award.
It was really wonderful. The University of Illinois is a class act.
Our listeners know your voice well, of course, but it also occurs to me that through your reports over the years, listeners have also gotten to sort of know the voices of the members of the Supreme Court themselves, the justices. As the High Court doesn't allow cameras and only in recent years has released any audio recordings of their oral arguments, we tend not to hear their voices and rely on you as a reporter and a court watcher, not just to tell us what they say, but how they say it. How much attention do you pay to trying to get an inflection or a turn of phrase just right?
An inflection, yes. A turn of phrase, yes. But I can't be a real imitator. I can't mimic the tone of the voice. I can't be a baritone or a bass or a soprano even. I have to really use my own voice and then as much as I can reflect what went on in the courtroom.
Do you get the sense, though, that maybe you sound a little bit different when you're quoting, say, Justice Scalia versus Justice Sotomayor?
Well, they, you know, the way they use words, the way they interact with counsel is different, although not as different as you might imagine. They're both New Yorkers.
How has the High Court changed since you began covering it for NPR?
Well, you know, when I first started it, covering the Supreme Court for NPR many, many moons ago, I won't tell you exactly how many years, but let's just say decades ago, many decades ago, I wouldn't have had a terrific oral argument story because the justices asked relatively few questions. It was a much less combative, quiet bench. The justices, and you couldn't tell where they were coming from. So often a justice would ask the most aggressive questions to counsel who he ended up agreeing with. And I say he because it was a he in those days, always a he. And you really couldn't forecast how cases were going to come out. And I would say now, three quarters of the time, you have a pretty good idea based on the kinds of questions and from whom they come, where the court is going. And the questions are absolutely rat-a-tat-tat, rapid-fire. They are often as many as 10 or 15 questions in the first couple of minutes. So that there are days when you really think that counsel is just a pawn, an excuse for the justices to be able to argue back and forth.
Is it more fun for you to follow oral arguments that are that energized and that rapid-fire, or is it more fun when you think back to 20, 30 years ago, to try and suss out what some very reserved justices might have been thinking?
Well, they both have their charms. The charm of the old way was that you really had no idea how a case was going to turn out. And today there are very few, but there are significant surprises. In those days, everything was a surprise. You really had no idea most of the time how a case was going to turn out, unless it was just a slam dunk. And often the best indication that something was going to be a slam dunk is that there were no questions, that justices simply turned off and stopped asking questions of one side and they let the lawyer make essentially a speech. That just never happens today. So they both have their charms. This has great drama sometimes, but you can have rapid-fire questions about Section 14B, Section 2A, that are really very tortured and difficult and impossible to translate for radio as well.
You mentioned there are some surprises from time to time. What would you say, if you could think back over the last 10 years or so, are the biggest surprises, either in where a justice turned on an issue, how they determined to interpret a given law, what argument they used? Are there certain ones that stick out and say, well, I never saw that coming?
Well, I think the ACA case, the what we now call Obamacare case, was a huge surprise because not only of the outcome, but the grounds on which the court decided the case, that it was 5-4 and that the deciding justice was not Anthony Kennedy, as we all had speculated if it was 5-4 that it was going to be. It was Chief Justice John Roberts, and that the central grounds for his upholding the law would be not the Commerce Clause provision of the Constitution, but instead the taxing provision of the Constitution. And that secondly, the Medicaid expansion, which was a significant part of the law, with that the mandatory aspect of that was invalidated, and by a fairly lopsided vote. So there were many, many twists and turns in that case that made it a big surprise. If I were to think of one other one, it would probably be the first big cases about imprisoning detainees
At
Guantanamo or the War on Terror. The very first case, Hamdi, involved an American-born detainee captured on the battlefield, and the court, by an 8-1 vote essentially, said you can't do that. You can't just hold an American citizen, and he was an American citizen, although he hadn't lived here for decades. You can't hold an American citizen incommunicado for months, if not years, with no end in sight, with no counsel available to him, and that kind of blank check was not permissible. And even in the case of the detainees who were not American citizens and who were at Guantanamo, the court said that by a 6-3 vote that those detainees had the right to challenge their detention under the habeas corpus provision of the Constitution. And the sixth vote was the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, who's a very, very conservative member of the court.
What rulings are you looking forward to reading, interpreting, processing, and reporting on this spring?
Well, there is sort of an embarrassment of riches this spring, yet to come embarrassment of riches. I'll just name a very few that come to mind. Obviously, there's the Proposition 8 same-sex marriage case from California, which has all kinds of questions involved in the case, but ultimately could, but won't necessarily test the question of whether there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. Then there's the companion case testing the Defense of Marriage Act, the federal law enacted in 1996, which bars the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages that are legal in the states in which they occur, so that somebody who is, in this particular case, was a same-sex couple, one partner died, and the other partner, the surviving spouse, had to pay $350,000 in federal estate taxes that she would not have had to pay were she married to a man, and her marriage was legal in New York State. It just wasn't recognized by the federal government. And there are hundreds of federal laws like that come under the jurisdiction, essentially, of the Defense of Marriage Act and bar any sort of benefits for same-sex couples. So those are the two probably most high-profile. The other very high-profile case is the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court upheld tenuously 3 years ago, I think, or 3 or 4 years ago, in an 8-1 vote. The Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the court's opinion, had very little good to say about the Voting Rights Act in modern day America, and said, but we should avoid striking it down right now and give Congress a chance. And three years later, it's got another case, and it looks very much as if it may strike down the Voting Rights Act in all probability. If it does so, it'll do so by a 5-4 vote. there's a very interesting privacy case involving whether states or the federal government can take your DNA when you are arrested for a crime, though not yet convicted, and then run it through the data system to see if there's a match for any other crime. And in this case, that's exactly what they did. The guy who was arrested pled guilty to a misdemeanor, and in the meantime, they'd matched him to a felony rape case, and he was convicted of that and sent to prison for life. So the question is, the question here is whether before you're convicted of anything, whether they can take your DNA and use that to try to find other crimes that you may have committed. This case comes from Maryland. They destroy the DNA afterwards if you're acquitted, but if you're convicted, obviously, it goes into the data bank. And if you're not, what are the privacy concerns here? And you can, that may sound simple, but if you can do that, then could they go up to the your mailbox, as one professor said recently, and get the DNA off of your mailbox and use that to look and see if there are any matches in the system? It's a very interesting, difficult question that pits privacy against law enforcement and a lot of law enforcement practices that have been around for a long time. And how is this different from fingerprinting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? The Supreme Court, by the way, has never ruled that fingerprinting is constitutional, but I don't think there's any question about that at the moment. there's a very big case that's probably going to be argued, I think, to be argued in April, that involves the in this particular case the gene for breast cancer, a gene for breast cancer, and a drug company spent an enormous amount of money developing a test to see whether you have that gene, and in doing that they essentially patented the gene. And the question in this case is, can you have a patent on a gene? And if you can or you can't, it is going to have enormous ramifications for medicine in the United States of America. So those are just a very few of the cases that quickly come to mind.
Do you think the cases the Supreme Court is hearing today are becoming harder and harder to define, refine, interpret? You know, are we talking about sort of slight shadings of interpretations of the Constitution today versus decisions made 30, 40 years ago?
No. I mean, nobody's ever decided whether you can patent a gene. That's not a shading of anything. The Voting Rights Act, yes, it was decided in 1966 or 7 or something like that, the first time. It's been decided multiple times and upheld since then. But the question in this case is, has America changed significantly enough that that states' rights now trump the federal interest in preventing voting rights violations in certain kinds of cases that I'm not going to bother to go through,
yeah.
Section 2 versus Section 5. So I think, you know, certainly the same-sex marriage cases have never come before the court before. These are just as revolutionary and as interesting as and new and indicative of the era we live in as were the anti-war protests, the flag-burning cases, the legitimacy of the Vietnam War, all kinds of cases that came to the court decades and decades ago, or for that matter, school desegregation in its time. I mean, the people who are bringing to the court the case of same-sex marriage compare their case to the case of Loving versus Virginia, which in at a time when the Supreme Court for the first time said that laws that made it a crime to have an interracial marriage were a violation of the Constitution. And at the time that the court made that decision, there were 16 states in which interracial marriage was illegal, was a crime.
Have you always been fascinated with the Supreme Court and our legal system?
I don't know about always. The more you do it, the more interested you are in it. The more you know about something, the more interested you are in it. I think I've always been at least interested in the law as it plays out whether it's in the common, everyday criminal trial, I love covering trials. It's much more mundane from some people's point of view, but I really love covering trials. It's not a good year if I haven't gone to at least one trial.
Did you always set out to be a reporter?
Well, originally I probably wanted to be a detective like Nancy Drew, but that seemed unlikely, especially in those days. So I, from the time I was about 16, I always wanted to be a reporter.
Well, the skill set's similar.
It is somewhat similar. And also, but, you know, I think the part of being a reporter that isn't the same as being a detective is that you get to have a seat in the classroom of history, as it were, at least if you cover major institutions of government. And that's a lot of fun, sometimes more so than others.
You've been honored 7 times by the American Bar Association for continued excellence in legal reporting. What makes someone a good legal journalist?
Well, there are different kinds of legal journalism. You know, there is legal journalism for lawyers, which is quite different from what I do. It's not that lawyers don't like what I do. They do. The challenge for me is to make something sophisticated enough that the lawyers think they're learning something and simple enough so that lay people understand it and are interested and want to keep going with me. I'm not a lawyer. So if I had to understand it, I had to go through the hoops to understand it. That's the advantage of not being a lawyer. The unadvantage is that sometimes it takes me a little longer.
What would you say is the greatest challenge in effectively communicating how a court ruling has been interpreted as you're preparing a report for air? What's the big challenge?
Well, the easier cases are cases where there are living, breathing human people who illustrate the facts of a case. Much more difficult, frankly, is a case like Obamacare. It had all the bells and whistles of a political drama, thank God, but the actual legal questions in the case were very abstract and are very abstract. And so it was, that's a challenge to make people understand what the abstract theory is and how it fits into American history, because the Commerce Clause, which was what most of this case was about until John Roberts was the 5th vote on a different ground, the Commerce Clause has been a part of our legal landscape almost for the entire history of the country. And in the 20th century, the post-New Deal Court finally said the Commerce Clause allows both the state and the federal government to regulate business in a manner that helps people, that the right of contract, the personal property right of contract, doesn't trump everything.
I have to ask you something. This is something I read about you, and it took me back because I'd never heard this. But it's true. Your husband David is a trauma surgeon, right?
Right.
And I mean, maybe you've been asked this many times, but my understanding is that he treated you for injuries sustained on your honeymoon.
Well, we were on our honeymoon in 2000. It was a somewhat star-crossed honeymoon to begin with, because we were both widowed. We'd planned our wedding for November 19th, 2000, on the theory that the election would be over so all of our friends could attend without any difficulty whatsoever.
Oh, no.
So it was probably the only Sunday in November when people were available. It was between court cases, between everything. So first we had our wedding, then we go off on our honeymoon, where I'm watching the argument in the Florida Supreme Court on the television while I'm on my honeymoon.
As one would do, yes.
As one would, of course, do. And we were snorkeling one day fairly far off offshore, because we're both pretty strong swimmers, and I got run over by a small powerboat.
Wow.
And I'm very lucky to be alive. And he sort of levitated out of the water, signaling some guys who were in the inner part of the harbor taking kids around in an inner tube. And they came out to get us. He started towing me in. I didn't actually realize I'd been hit. I thought I'd been hit by a wave. Mm. And we started to swim in, and then I started to get dizzy, and I didn't really know what was happening to me, and he started towing me in. So they take us to the local hospital on Anguilla, where they call in a surgeon. They had one surgeon there already operating on somebody for, I don't know, a gallbladder. David goes up to the operating room, offers to relieve the guy so he can come operate on me, but he can't do that. So then he goes back downstairs, and this new guy on the island comes in, and David sort of starts walking him through the surgery just the way he would one of his residents. He wasn't taking any chances. So that's sort of the long and the short of it.
Wow. Well, I for one am glad you recovered from that. Wow. What do you plan to talk about when you visit the U of I campus on February 11th?
I wish I could tell you that I figured that out. I haven't written the speech yet. I assume I'll be meeting with students and faculty, but there is one speech I'm supposed to give, and I haven't decided whether I should make it sort of generically about the court or about the issues this term, or look at the court more historically, to talk about what were the issues when I first started covering the court compared to now. So what do you think I ought to do?
I think the answer is yes to all of those.
I can't do them all.
Finally, many of us here have long talked during pledge drives off the air about the idea that someday someone out there ought to create a Nina Totten bag. And much to my shock, there is one. Not long ago, they did that. How do you feel about your likeness displayed on tote bags used all across America?
I love it. And it's a very flattering picture that they've done sort of Andy Warhol, Marilyn Monroe style in many different color shades. And I think it's absolutely terrific. I just like it very much. What's not to like?
Oh, there's nothing not to like about it. I'm just still stunned that this idea that started as, frankly, kind of a bad pun turned into a real thing, and people love
now,
it.
You do know that I spent a year in Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, you did?
Yes. My dad was a visiting professor 1 year at the University of Illinois. He had planned to do just a year of teaching. He was a great concert violinist, and they asked him to teach for two semesters, which he did. And in my junior year of high school, I went to Urbana High, and we lived in Champaign right off the golf club.
Wow. You know, I do know your father, Roman Totenberg, passed away last year. My condolences on your loss. You spoke eloquently about your dad on NPR when he passed. Did he and your mother encourage your career in reporting?
Absolutely. But I don't think they ever really thought it would happen. You have to remember that in those days, you know, women really didn't have much in the way of professional jobs. And actually, I think my dad was more confident that I would be able to do this. My mother sort of saw the tea leaves of history and didn't expect that you could get hired as a woman to do something serious, which you couldn't when I was starting out. It was, you know, people just simply said, we don't hire women. And my dad, who came from a profession where there were lots of women, professional singers, violinists, cellists, flutists, very successful women, certainly in smaller numbers than men, but they existed in significant numbers, and they were some of his greatest colleagues. I don't think he thought it was quite as extraordinary.
You mentioned earlier your late first husband. It was the late Senator Floyd Haskell. I was curious what the dynamic was like of having the experience of reporting on the legal and political world while married to someone deeply ensconced in that world.
Well, fortunately, I really didn't have to entirely do that because we didn't get married until right after he was defeated.
Okay.
So while we dated, while he was in the Senate for, I guess, about a year and a half or so, I was never truly a Senate wife.
But I guess that sort of thing does come up from time to time if you're covering D.C. politics, right?
You know, I would studiously avoid anything that he was involved in. He was on, fortunately for me, the Finance Committee and the Energy Committee and the Commerce Committees, and they were all things that I had no jurisdiction over whatsoever. So, and furthermore, knew almost nothing about. So I didn't have to worry about a conflict of interest with him and his work. And to add just sort of a patina to the whole thing, he was a Republican turned Democrat. So
your bases were covered either way.
Yeah, my bases were covered in all ways.
Nina Totenberg, congratulations again on winning the Illinois Prize, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my real pleasure. Thanks so much. And by the way, folks out there, have you given to WILL? Because if you haven't, somebody's going to come get you.
The pledge enforcement vans are on their way now.
The pledge enforcement vans driven by me are on their way now.
All right. Nina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. She will be on the University of Illinois campus on Monday to give a talk at 2 p.m. in the auditorium at the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology. That's at 405 North Matthews Avenue in Urbana. The talk is free and open to the public. Coming up, a conversation with virus hunter Nathan Wolf, who is also headed to the University of Illinois campus on Monday. We will discuss how to forecast and ultimately prevent new viruses from becoming pandemics. First, a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On Monday, the University of Illinois will host a virus hunter. His name is Dr. Nathan Wolf, and he is a visiting professor in human biology at Stanford University. He's also the founder and CEO of the company Metabiota and founder and executive chairman of Global Viral. Both organizations, one for-profit, one nonprofit, are dedicated to reducing threats from and promoting understanding of the microbial world. I spoke earlier this week with Dr. Wolf about his upcoming visit and his life's work. Dr. Wolf will be on campus to discuss how to forecast and ultimately prevent new viruses from becoming pandemics. The College of ACEs and the Office of International Programs are sponsoring the visit as part of the 2013 PRISM's Global Health Lecture Series. Dr. Wolf's talk will be at noon Monday in the auditorium at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at 1205 West Clark Street in Urbana. It is free and open to the public. Again, a reminder, as our conversation was pre-recorded, we are not taking calls today. Dr. Nathan Wolf, welcome to Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
How can we prevent pandemics before they happen?
Well, that's like one of the fundamental questions of microbiology at sort of this moment in history. What we know is that the costs associated with these events are incredible. So if we look at whether it be influenza pandemics like the 1918 flu or pandemics like the HIV pandemic, the cost and burden that the global human population bears associated with these events is just almost unfathomable. And by and large, our response to it has been a little bit like a cardiologist that sort of waits for the heart attack and then does the best they can to respond. We have, by and large, not had the capacity to really get ahead of these different epidemics. And, what's really changed, though, is our understanding of the way in which they emerge, the regions which really tend to be hotspots for emergence, the behaviors that are associated with the sort of movement and emergence of these pathogens. And we really have gotten a lot better. We've gone to the point where we really can think about sort of understanding how these things emerge and putting ourselves in a position where we can catch them before they spread.
As I said, you are sort of known as, promoted as a virus hunter. I've also heard you referred to at times as the Indiana Jones of virus hunting, rightly or wrongly. What do you suppose that characterization refers to?
Well, look, what we do is we study the diversity of microbes around the world, and we spend a lot of time really trying to catch the nasty ones. Part of the mission of Global Viral is really to sort of engage the public in a discourse about these things, and of course, some of these titles are a little bit ridiculous, but at the end of the day, if it helps people to really become interested in these phenomena and to think about them and realize that the cost of these epidemics and the importance of coming up with systems that are capable of really sort of addressing them, then, they can call me whatever they like, and that's fine with me.
You have sought, among other things, to examine how certain epidemic diseases get their start. What do HIV and SARS and West Nile virus and other fairly well-known and aggressive viruses tend to have in common?
Well, it's one of these really interesting things that I think for some people seems a little bit counterintuitive, but all of the major sort of pandemics of humanity, these have been emerged from animal reservoirs and mostly from wild animals. You know, so if you take a look at SARS, this is a bat virus that jumped over into human populations. If you take a look at influenza, these are bird viruses that sometimes, you know, stop over in different mammals, but ultimately are bird viruses that enter into humans. HIV, the main form of HIV, HIV-1, that's a chimpanzee virus. And sort of the recognition, you know, really increasingly over the last 10 years or so of the fundamental importance of wild animal reservoirs for the emergence of these different viruses has really provided us with sort of a route forward in terms of understanding what the reservoirs of these diseases are and understanding, you know, how the contact between human and populations can and these animal populations can be modified to really sort of decrease these emergence events. And those are some of the fundamental activities that organizations like our own and other collaborators are out there doing our best to do.
You know, we live on this planet with lots of animals. Is it possible for us to eradicate such contact?
Well, we certainly can be a lot wiser, and yeah, we absolutely can decrease sort of risky contact. I mean, you know, there are some, you know, it's sort of like a good news, bad news situation, a little bit of good news and a little bit of bad news. You know, the world has changed in some really fundamental ways, and there's a lot more connections between people, and there's quite a few connections between humans and animals. These are all things that sort of increase the chances that we will have things spill over. But there also has been a, you know, more of a concentration on a smaller number of animals. You know, in our historical past, we really hunted all wild animals, but that's a smaller and smaller percentage of the world that does that. And there really is the potential to provide protein alternatives and move from wild animal consumption to domestic animal consumption. And these are certainly things that will decrease the rates of contact with animals. But, you know, and this is sort of what some people refer to as sort of the bushmeat crisis in some parts of the world, like Central Africa, where, you know, I lived for about 5 years and our project spends, you know, has been working inconsistently for the last 12 or 13 years. Now, this is one of the parts of the world where people still do depend, particularly in rural areas, on wild animals. And this is a real central issue for humanity. This is not some sort of niche or boutique conservation issue. You know, the reliance on wild animals increases the probability that we're going to have, you know, more and more of these pandemics in the future. It also creates a major sort of food security issue. In the sense that these are not sustainable sources of animal protein, so individuals and populations that depend on them are going to be, you know, at really sort of exquisite risk for food security issues. And on top of that, obviously, there is a conservation issue as well. So, you know, we're hunting and sort of, you know, decimating some of the most valuable species on our planet because we don't sort of take seriously the issues of poverty alleviation, and the resource needs of some of the poorest populations in the world living in places like Central Africa. And so I think this is a problem which is not, you know, for a group of people who love animals or for a group of people who really care, you know, about rural poverty in Africa. This is really about everybody. This is everybody's problem, because when we have an HIV pandemic or a nasty flu virus, it's often people in these rural parts of the world that sort of depend on subsistence sort of, you know, animal proteins. That's really one of the big problems. That's something that we all have to figure out ways to address.
So that's why then areas like Central Africa tend to be what you might call viral hotspots?
Well, you know, it's sort of there's a lot of people out there now and this, you know, that have emerged that are doing work like this and trying to really identify what the hotspots are, including our group and colleagues and many projects we have. The reality is we're just sort of at the beginning of being able to identify what the real hotspots are. But there's some trends that really have begun to emerge. And those are trends associated with the diversity of wild animals, And places like Southeast Asia and Central Africa, they have a lot of diversity of these wild animals. It's factors like how much contact is there between human and animal populations. It's questions like how close are these regions with a lot of wild animals in contact with those animals to major population centers that may be able to sort of amplify and really be the kind of kindling that would permit, you know, an exotic virus that had jumped over to a few people to really go global. And, you know, it's all those factors sort of putting them together. But, you know, certainly not all parts of the world are equally risky, and we're learning more and more each day about which parts of the world, you know, really are the riskiest.
Why do you suppose it matters how diverse the animal population is, how many different species we're talking about? Is it just more likely that an exotic virus will find its way from a more exotic animal into the human population than if it were animals that were commonly exposed to?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the way to think of it is this. Really, over time, what happens is each species of animal, each species of plant and fungus, and really even bacteria, end up housing their own sort of groups of viruses to themselves. So, for example, you know, dogs have a different sort of repertoire of microbes that infect them than do, say, humans or some species of macaque monkey that lives in Asia. And so if you imagine that each species has its own particular agents that are associated with it, the more particular species that a population of humans has contact with, the higher the probability that one of those agents will be able to cross and really be able to spread and cause harm in human populations. And that's sort of, you know, so it's just the more animals that are out there, the more bugs that are out there.
What makes a particular virus more dangerous than another? I mean, what's the difference between your run-of-the-mill viral infection and, say, Ebola or West Nile?
Yeah, so, well, you know, when we think about these agents, there's really, you know, two major factors that we think of, and those are how harmful is the particular agent? So how deadly is it, or how much harm does it cause? And the second one is how transmissible is it? How easy is it for the bug to spread from person to person? And you could sort of, you know, I sometimes imagine these as sort of little dials that are moving back and forth sometime. And for each agent, they're going to fall somewhere on the spectrum for each of those different criteria. So if we take a virus like, say, Ebola, which is obviously a very dramatic virus, it's a virus that we spend a lot of time working on and studying. But if we really ask the question very carefully of how dangerous is it to the global human population, well, it has a very high mortality. So a large percentage of individuals who are infected with Ebola will go on to die. Having said that, the probability that any of those individuals will spread the virus and how sort of successful the virus is in spreading in human populations is actually quite low. So these are viruses, you know, now the problem is viruses have a tendency to gain the capacity to change in one way or another, and we only understand and know of a very small percentage of the Ebola viruses that are out there. But for the moment, it's one that, you know, is very dramatic, but is not necessarily at the very top of our list for things that could be devastating. Now, take another virus, like, for example, H5N1, so, you know, sometimes referred to as the bird flu. H5N1... this is a virus which is highly deadly to humans. You know, by some estimates, up to 50% of the individuals that are infected go on to, you know, have very severe illness and die. You know, for the moment, fortunately, it does not appear to be very transmissible, but it comes from a class of viruses, the influenza viruses, which historically, of course, can be very transmissible. You know, so something like H5N1, because it has that combination of deadliness and perhaps the potential for transmissibility, and that sort of comes from a class of viruses that can spread, that sort of moves it up on our sort of danger radar, if you will.
So what are you working on right now? What sort of research and public health projects are top of mind?
Well, we collaborate collaborate on a whole range of different, you know, different projects, and we work with a number of different partners. You know, one of the things that we've been very busy doing is going through and trying to chart out all of these little outbreaks that never get a diagnosis. So, you know, what happens, believe it or not, is sort of, I think people have this vision of, say, you know, the CDC or WHO responding like the FBI responds to, you know, every murder, that the WHO and CDC are out there, and every time people die and we don't know what it is, they go out and they find the cause, and, you know, there's a big system to sort of pull these things in. And, you know, while these are wonderful institutions, you know, they're often underfunded, and the reality is every year and even every month and probably every week, somewhere in the world, there's an outbreak where individuals are infected and die from a particular agent, and there is never a cause that is attributed to that particular agent. Now, many of these things will be garden variety illnesses that just, you know, they happen in a very isolated part of the world, but some of them are caused by agents that we are unfamiliar with. We don't know how they spread, how they cause disease. We have no vaccines for them. And so what we've been, you know, really one of the things that we've been doing has been, you know, I think sort of very exciting for us, and we believe to be very important, is working with collaborators in countries around the world to find these outbreaks, these localized outbreaks, and to push to the edge the diagnostics. And so, for example, you know, last year we reported on a completely new virus that had never been identified before that causes hemorrhagic fever. So the same kind of symptoms that you see in Ebola virus. And we did this with colleagues in San Francisco and organizations like UCSF, and then with collaborators in the field, colleagues from Gabon and from the Democratic Republic of Congo, organizations like INRB and CIRM, and we basically worked through some of these outbreaks and again found a virus that was completely unknown to science. Now, you know, by identifying these viruses, what that means is they, you know, the genetic information goes into our libraries so other people can identify these things more easily when they come about. We can start to test them with partners who have, you know, much more sort of sophisticated laboratories where they can culture the virus, see how it, you know, really understand how it causes illness, try to start developing drugs and vaccines against it. You know, and this is really one of the fundamental ways that we can get ahead of these particular outbreaks and pandemics.
If the WHO and the CDC don't have the kind of funding necessary to address everything that happens out there, how do you have funding to pursue these sorts of investigations?
Well, you know, it's sort of what's been very sort of fortunate is that over the last 10 years or so, like when we started this work, there was maybe a very small handful of people that really were sort of trying to sort of sound the alarm bell and say, look, we're going to be experiencing more and more of these pandemics, and we need to find systems. You know, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, so we need to go out and not just wait for the heart attack to happen, but to stop these pandemics early. Fortunately now, there's a range of organizations, so this has become a sort of a much more diversified effort, and I think that there's some real strengths and benefits to that. The, you know, the veterinary and conservation communities have really, really sort of been engaged. We work very closely, for example, with colleagues at UC Davis, at their One Health Institute, and at the, you know, Wildlife and Veterinary Centers at UC Davis to sort of engage with veterinarians around the world to work on this. And then you have new governmental organizations. For example, USAID has a very active program now in emerging pandemic threats where it engages with organizations around the world, international organizations like our own and UC Davis, and a whole range of different partners in many countries around the world to try to sort of improve infrastructure and training and increase the kinds of systems that are out there that are going to be able to most effectively monitor and identify these agents before they really become sort of the next HIV. So the landscape is really sort of dramatically changing, and there's a number of partners from USAID to traditional partners like Health and Human Services to some great organizations within the U.S. military that are really collaborating in very intensive ways to play their role in understanding and stopping these outbreaks.
What would you say about the life and work of an epidemiologist might surprise people?
That's a great question. For me, I see so many different opportunities within sort of microbiology and epidemiology that I see these as almost, beyond disciplines. They almost, they really sort of have, there's so much in the future that people will do in these areas. I think, one of the things that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and, writing about increasingly is also sort of the microbiome. A lot of people, I think, including our own organization, have been very focused on the bad actors. And I think that makes a lot of sense because, there's a lot of benefits to human health and disease associated with identifying the bad microbes and trying to stop them. But, one of the things that increasingly we're recognizing as microbiologists is how incredibly diverse the microbes are which infect us and which spread in human populations and animal communities. And we're just beginning to understand the implications of this diversity of bugs, and many of them will not be deadly. In fact, most of them won't be deadly. Some of them will be neutral, and some of them will have the potential to provide huge benefits to humanity. And I think, one of the areas where epidemiology and microbiology, I predict that these fields will go in the future is not simply to focus on the negative ones, even though we still have a lot of work to do there, but to also really figure out what are the positive forces in microbes that are either stopping the deadly ones from being more deadly or that are helping us to address chronic diseases that maybe we're not even aware of.
Finally, you're coming to the University of Illinois to give a talk on Monday. What do you intend to talk about?
Well, it's a great opportunity, and I'm really looking forward to the talk. There's a real sort of history of science at the institution, which I think is, very sort of relevant to these topics. And, obviously the diversity of different schools that are engaged in research related to epidemiology and microbiology. And I'm certainly going to talk quite a bit about some of the approaches that we've had to combating pandemics and really thinking about sort of how do we go through the agents out there and really understand them in such a way that will improve our capacity in the coming decade to really surmount these risks. I also probably will spend a little bit of time talking about some of the positive bugs and how we can kind of contextualize the bad actors into these really fascinating and diverse communities of bugs, some of which really will have a lot of potential to help us.
Dr. Nathan Wolf is founder and CEO of Metabiota, a company specializing in microbiological research products and services. He's also founder and executive chairman of Global Viral, which is a nonprofit designed to promote understanding, exploration, and stewardship of the microbial world. He'll give a lecture Monday in the National Center for Supercomputing Applications Auditorium at noon on viral forecasting for pandemic prevention. Dr. Wolf, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Nathan Wolf in a conversation recorded earlier this week. Again, that talk will be noon Monday in the auditorium at the NCSA at 1205 West Clark Street in Urbana. It is free and open to the public. There's more information about Dr. Wolf's lecture as well as Nina Totenberg's talk on our website. Just visit today's program post at will.illinois.edu/focus, where we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program. Also, a reminder that if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day. You can also listen back to past programs online at your leisure. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. We have some more great programs in store for you in the coming days. On Monday, we'll discuss the challenges inherent in developing a proper work-life balance. something most of us struggle with from time to time, how to dedicate yourself effectively in your job without sacrificing relationships or experiences outside of the workplace. We'll talk with John DeGraff, executive director of an initiative called Take Back Your Time. It's dedicated to challenging what it characterizes as an epidemic of overwork, overscheduling, and time famine that threatens our health, our families, relationships, communities, and environment. We'll also talk with Deborah Stone, Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois, about the role companies and organizations can play in ensuring proper work-life balance for its employees. That's on Monday's program. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.